Welcome back to the Deep Dive. And if you are joining us today, you are right on time for a conversation that gets to the absolute core of how we talk about, well, justice, authority, and public trust.
Yeah, it is a heavy one today.
It really is. Our mission today is to examine this highly sensitive, honestly, incredibly compelling essay. It's written by Eric Sanders of the Sanders Firm PC.
Right. Dated April 10th, 2026.
Exactly. And it's titled, Accountability is Not Anti-Police, the Dangerous Fiction Behind the Duran Defense. We've got a massive stack of notes on this piece, and we are going to try to extract the underlying mechanics of how public commentary actually shapes our democratic institutions.
And before we take a single step forward, we really need to lay down the ground rules for you, the listener.
Yeah, absolutely crucial.
Because the material we're analyzing today touches on incredibly raw nerves. I mean, it involves law enforcement, the judicial system, and the kind of high-stakes public debate that usually, you know, ends in a shouting match.
Right. People get very defensive.
They do. So our goal today is strictly analytical. We are not here to take a political side, and we are not endorsing the author's viewpoint.
We're just the messengers.
Exactly. We are going to impartially unpack the logic of Sanders' essay, looking purely at the mechanics of the arguments he presents.
Right. We are looking under the hood of the rhetoric here. Mm-hmm. So, to set the stage, the essay is grounded in a deeply tragic, factual foundation. It revolves around the death of a civilian named Eric Dupre.
Right.
And the subsequent conviction and sentencing of former NYPD Sergeant Eric Duran. And the essay establishes a fundamental premise right out of the gate.
Which is that this event is a tragedy with absolutely no winners.
None. A civilian lost his life. A police officer's career and freedom are gone. Families on both sides are dealing with permanent, devastating consequences.
And that reality, Sanders argues, demands a level of restraint and seriousness.
Which brings us to the core focus of the analysis. Because, interestingly, the essay doesn't actually spend its time relitigating the trial.
No, it really doesn't. It's not about the courtroom strategy or, you know, specific penal codes.
Right. The entire focus is on the reaction to the legal outcome.
Specifically, how certain union leaders and media outlets took this solemn judicial ruling and transformed it into a weapon of narrative warfare.
Narrative warfare. That's a strong term. To understand how that works, let's use an analogy. Imagine for a second that you, the listener, are standing on a massive, vital suspension bridge.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
It's a marvel of engineering. It carries thousands of people every single day, but suddenly it shutters. A main support cable snaps.
Oh, wow. So a major structural failure.
Exactly. Now, in that moment, you would expect structural engineers to come in, right?
Yeah.
To examine the broken cable objectively and figure out exactly what went wrong so they can prevent another disaster.
That would be the logical response, yeah.
Right. What you absolutely would not expect is for the bridge operators to hold a press conference claiming that the safety inspector just hates bridges.
Right. Or saying that checking the cables is some insulting attack on the entire engineering profession.
Exactly. Because that would be terrifying.
It would be. Because when a system built on public trust experiences a failure, we crave objective, dispassionate analysis.
We need the failure isolated.
We need it understood so the system can improve. But when you step out of the realm of steel and concrete and step into the realm of human lives, state-sanctioned force, and institutional loyalty,
things get messy.
Very messy. That objectivity often shatters completely.
And that shattering is exactly what we see in the first major reaction the essay critiques. It focuses on the response from Vincent J. Vallelong,
the president of the Sergeants Benevolent Association.
Right, the SBA. He's a 36-year NYPD veteran. Following Duran's sentencing, Vallelong issued a statement calling it, and I quote, one of the darkest days in the history of the law enforcement profession.
Yeah, that's heavy rhetoric.
Very heavy. He also placed a massive emphasis on the idea that Duran had to make a split-second decision.
Now, looking at the underlying logic of the essay, Sanders' critique here isn't just that a union president defended a union member.
I mean, defending members is literally the job description of a union leader, right?
Exactly. The issue for Sanders is the specific method and the rhetoric used to do it. Vallelong holds a position of massive institutional significance.
So when he speaks,
he isn't just issuing a PR statement. He is actively shaping the internal culture and the psychology of policing for thousands of officers.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second because I want to steelman the union's position.
Sure, go ahead.
If you are leading a team in profession that is genuinely dangerous, where people are putting their lives on the line, doesn't a leader have to fiercely defend their people?
You'd think so, yeah.
It sounds almost like a sports coach automatically blaming the referee for a loss. You know, you do it to protect the team's morale, to keep them functioning under immense pressure.
That is a really common way to look at it. But the analysis argues that this approach is actually a profound failure of professional leadership.
Really? How so?
Well, the sports coach analogy falls apart because a lost game doesn't result in a loss of constitutional rights or human life.
Ah, right. The stakes are completely different.
Entirely different. Authentic leadership in a life or death profession requires judgment. Sanders says there's a distinct line between standing beside a union member as a human being who is suffering.
Which is a valid.
Very valid. But that's different from actively undermining the constitutional standards that give police their authority to operate in the first place.
Sure, but practically speaking, if I'm a police officer on the street dealing with unpredictable, highly volatile situations, if I feel like my union boss won't go to bat for me unconditionally when things go wrong, doesn't that paralyze me?
That's the fear.
Right. Like, if I hesitate for even 2 seconds because I'm worried about being abandoned by my leadership, that hesitation could literally get me or someone else killed.
And that is exactly the fear that drives this kind of rhetoric. It's a very real, very human fear. The reality of policing involves trauma, danger, and intense, often unfair public scrutiny.
So it makes sense they'd circle the wagons.
It does. But Sanders argues here that unconditional defense, when it involves attacking the legal system itself, creates a far more dangerous kind of paralysis.
How does it do that?
When a union president declares that a legal sentence for one individual officer is a dark day for the entire profession, he is collapsing the individual into the institution.
Oh, I see. He's telling every other officer to experience someone else's legal accountability as their own personal injury.
Precisely. If you are studying institutional ethics, this is the exact moment the alarm bell should go off in your head.
Because it shifts the baseline of what's acceptable.
Yes. The rhetoric teaches rank-and-file officers that legal scrutiny is not a normal part of holding state power, but rather a hostile attack.
Wow.
It sends a message that the real scandal isn't the tragic death that occurred, but the fact that an officer was judged under the law at all.
It tells officers that the law itself is an enemy.
Exactly.
And if the law is the enemy, how can you effectively enforce it? It creates this massive cognitive dissonance.
It really does.
But Sanders notes that this strategy of grievance didn't stop at elevating the officer and attacking the outcome.
No, it spilled over.
Right. What really escalates this situation into a systemic issue is that this rhetoric didn't stay confined to an internal union memo.
It requires a receptive audience to take hold.
And that is where the media ecosystem comes into play, which introduces the second major force in this analysis.
The New York Post editorial board.
Yeah. The essay tracks how an internal grievance is transformed into a full-blown civic emergency. The media acts as a massive public megaphone,
amplifying the union's framing and taking it to a much broader audience.
And the language used in that amplification is incredibly aggressive.
Oh, absolutely.
The essay highlights that the Post called Judge Guy Mitchell a lunatic.
Yeah.
They labeled the legal sentence judicial abuse. They even went as far as predicting that this single ruling would lead to crime spiking because officers would be too terrified to make arrests.
A lot of fear mongering.
But again, let's look at the reality of the media landscape here. Aren't editorial boards supposed to be forceful?
Well, yes.
Isn't their entire purpose to have a strong, non-neutral, even provocative opinion?
They absolutely are. It is entirely within the bounds of responsible opinion journalism to forcefully disagree with a legal outcome.
Like debating the technicality.
Exactly. An editorial board might argue that a judge misinterpreted a specific statute or that a sentence was wildly disproportionate to the offense.
Right.
But Sanders draws a sharp distinction between that kind of rigorous debate and what he describes here as propaganda in editorial dress.
Because calling a judge a lunatic isn't exactly a rigorous legal argument.
No, it's not. It discards legal judgment in favor of insult, agitation, and institutional rage.
So it changes the whole nature of the conversation.
It does. The mechanism at work here isn't just criticism, it's delegitimization. When a major publication claims that a judge had it in for the cop all along, they are executing a very specific strategy. They are framing the concept of judicial review, which, mind you, is a standard, essential function of the courts, as an inherent, anti-police bias.
Oh, so if you convince the public that the judge is just a crazy person with a vendetta,
right,
then the actual facts of the case or the legal reasoning don't matter anymore. The court's authority is essentially neutralized in the minds of the readers.
Exactly. It's a way of short-circuiting logical debate. If the institution is corrupt, you don't have to engage with its findings.
That's a dangerous precedent.
It is.
Yeah.
But destroying the legitimacy of the judge is really only half of the equation required to completely reorder the moral framework of a case like this.
What's the other half?
To make this narrative hold up, you also have to change how the public views the person who died.
Which brings us to the most uncomfortable, but perhaps the most crucial part of the analysis. You have to systematically delegitimize the victim. Let's look at how both the union leadership and the editorial board talked about Eric Dupree. The essay points out that they repeatedly used phrases like drug dealer with a criminal record.
Or a drug suspect.
Yeah, an apparent criminal, and simply perp.
And we have to ask why those specific words are chosen. Because this isn't just descriptive filler to save space on a page.
No, definitely not.
This language is performing a very deliberate, very powerful psychological function.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because it acts almost like a linguistic magic trick.
How so?
Well, think about how you react to a headline. When you strip away a person's name, their identity as a father or a son, and you replace their entire humanity with a label like perp.
You're changing the empathy dynamic.
Exactly. You are bypassing the empathy centers of the brain. You are designing a narrative specifically to make the public care less about the loss of human life.
That is the exact mechanism of outgrouping.
Outgrouping.
Yeah. In behavioral psychology, when we place someone in an outgroup, especially a stigmatized category, we view their suffering as less morally difficult to accept.
Wow.
Sanders points out the deep cynicism of this structure. If the victim can be successfully reduced to a negative stereotype, then any violence against them becomes more tolerable to the public.
Because they're seen as less than.
Right. And consequently, any legal scrutiny of the officer's conduct can be easily painted as excessive or driven by some political agenda.
But the reality, and the essay really hammers this home, is that a category does not dissolve the consequence of death.
No, it doesn't.
A human being doesn't become less dead just because a newspaper finds their biography rhetorically useful for an editorial.
And more importantly for the justice system, a person's biography does not answer the legal question of whether a specific use of force was justified in a specific moment.
Right. The law doesn't say force is okay if the guy had a record.
Exactly. The law, by its very design, is supposed to apply universally, regardless of a person's background or past mistakes.
So by obsessively focusing the narrative on the victim's past,
the rhetoric attempts to distract the public from the actions that are actually under legal review in the present.
It's a sleight of hand.
It really is.
Look over here at the victim's history, so you don't look over there at the mechanics of the incident itself.
Precisely.
So let's step back and synthesize the pieces we've just unpacked here. We have an internal grievance generated by union leadership that equates legal accountability with an attack.
Check.
We have a massive media apparatus that amplifies that grievance, discarding neutral journalism to delegitimize the judiciary.
Right.
And we have a coordinated use of language to dehumanize the victim and suppress public empathy. What happens when you mix all of these together?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where Sanders' analysis moves from a critique of a single case to a diagnosis of systemic decay.
Systemic decay.
Yes. The essay argues that these forces work together to create a highly dangerous feedback loop of resentment.
A feedback loop.
Yeah. So the union supplies the grievance from inside the profession, effectively teaching officers that society is out to get them.
And then the media amplifies it.
Exactly. The media provides the public megaphone, validating that internal fear by telling society that the police are, in fact, victims of an unjust system.
It creates an incredibly toxic us versus them pathology.
It really does.
And if you think about how institutions function, this raises a massive red flag. Law enforcement relies absolutely on public trust to operate safely and effectively.
It's the bedrock of policing.
Right. But if the institution insists that it must be protected from the very laws it enforces against everyone else, isn't that just a ticking time bomb for its own credibility?
It is the definition of unsustainable. And that is the ultimate conclusion drawn in the essay.
You can't have it both ways.
No, you cannot have state-sanctioned power and simultaneously claim immunity from the rules governing that power. The argument here is that supporting police and supporting professional legal standards are not competing positions.
They shouldn't be.
In a healthy democratic society, they had to be the exact same position. Accountability cannot be treated as an optional feature just because a judicial outcome is emotionally devastating or politically inconvenient.
Because if the badge means anything at all, it means you are bound by the law, not insulated from it.
Exactly.
The authority of the badge comes from the Constitution. If you attack the legal system that upholds the Constitution, you are effectively cutting off the branch you are sitting on.
That is the exact paradox Sanders is highlighting. By converting a tragic event into this kind of narrative warfare, the union leadership and the editorial board aren't just defending one officer's split-second decision.
What are they doing then?
According to the analysis, they are eroding the foundational legitimacy of policing itself. A profession that is entrusted with the authority to use force simply cannot sustain public faith if it views judicial scrutiny as an act of hostility.
It just doesn't work.
It is an impossible, contradictory position for any democratic institution to maintain over the long term.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Today, we have strictly analyzed the mechanics of how rhetoric shapes institutional reality.
We covered a lot of ground.
We did. We've traced the journey of a deeply tragic incident and seen how the reaction to it was converted into an internal grievance.
Right.
We explored how that grievance equated lawful accountability with an institutional injury. We examined how a media outlet amplified that feeling, using specific psychological and linguistic tactics to delegitimize a judge and dehumanize a victim.
Yeah.
And we explored the core warning of the text, that this kind of narrative warfare threatens the very legitimacy of democratic institutions by demanding that police be insulated from the laws they are sworn to enforce.
And that leaves us with a final vital thought for you to mull over, one that extends directly from the framework we've just discussed. Well, if this kind of narrative warfare is ultimately successful, if it genuinely convinces both the public and rank-and-file police officers that they are inherent adversaries locked in some endless battle for survival, what happens to the everyday concept of community policing?
Oh, wow. That's a chilling thought.
It is.
If every single routine interaction, like a traffic stop, a noise complaint, even just asking for directions, if that is preloaded with this artificially constructed, heavily amplified us versus them resentment,
it fundamentally changes the nature of society.
It really does.
It raises the terrifying possibility that routine, non-controversial cooperation between citizens and law enforcement might eventually become psychologically impossible.
Because they just don't trust each other.
Right. If both sides are trained by the media and union rhetoric to view the other as an existential threat, the basic social contract breaks down entirely.
Think back to that suspension bridge we talked about at the very beginning of the deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
If we are constantly trained to attack the safety inspector every single time they point out a flaw, eventually we are just going to stop looking for cracks altogether.
We'll ignore the structural stress because acknowledging it has become too politically painful.
And that is exactly when the bridge actually falls.
Yeah.
Keep questioning the narratives you encounter. Look closely at how arguments are constructed around you. And thank you for joining us on this deep dive.